and democratic than is the United States. To many, it even resembles the Soviet Union in some ways. This image is fairly strong, and it includes real and imaginary things. Compulsory military training and service, an overtly religious society, and rumors of restrictions on leaving the country are all upsetting to a Soviet Jew. It is perhaps understandable why many Soviet Jews would prefer to emigrate to a rich and free country with a reputation for stability, peace, a high standard of living, work opportunities, and, perhaps most important of all, the right to be left alone. / For a Russian, the joy not to care a damn about anything political is a precious joy. The opportunity to be free from any obligation, from having to be anything, not even a Jew, if one so chooses, is synonymous with freedom in the minds of many Soviet Jews. America's diverse and developed culture, famous cities, and a temperate climate explain the tendency of Soviet Jews to prefer the United States over Israel. Asterisk, emphasis supplied. Noteworthy in Dranov's article is a remarkable statement that the chief form of oppression in the Soviet Union is not, as we thought, the lack of religious freedom, but rather the constant shortage of consumer goods. That is, food, money, clothes, cars, apartments, etc. Another objection of many Soviet emigres to going to Israel, he says, is the climate. It's too hot. This is something that God seems to have overlooked in selecting a suitable promised land. On the other hand, Dranov points out that the Soviet Jews prefer to emigrate to a rich and free country with a reputation for stability, a high standard of living, and work opportunities. It appears that nothing has changed in the last 10 years since Dranov wrote his article. The Los Angeles Times, June 23, 1989, reports that the Anti-Defamation League and other Jewish agencies are trying hard to induce Soviet Jewish emigres to go to Israel, but are having little success. The Times concludes the report in these words, "But the Soviets are not buying. Israel's climate is too hot," says one. "Its people are too religious," complains another. "Hebrew is too hard to learn," says a third. A fourth young man feels the streets of Israel are unsafe. He wants to settle in Detroit. The tragedy of all this is that the Shamish Aaron plan for the West Bank and Gaza is to dispossess the Palestinian people of land upon which their ancestors have lived for centuries, and to which they are passionately attached, upon the pretext of making room for people whose ancestors may have lived there 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, but who themselves have never lived there, and do not want to live there. Unless forced to by the Israeli government. Authors note, the foregoing chapter was written in June of 1989, before the dramatic upheavals in Eastern Europe occurred. As of this writing, March 1990, the political instability currently prevalent in Eastern Europe has caused some concern among the Jewish population of certain Soviet bloc nations about the possibility of a revival of indigenous antisemitism. This is happening at a time when the US has decided that Jewish citizens of the Soviet Union can no longer be properly classified for immigration purposes as oppressed people, and thus entitled to the status of refugees. The consequence has been to reduce and limit the number of Soviet immigrants accepted into the US annually. Therefore, this recent combination of circumstances has resulted in a significant increase in the number of Soviet Jews immigrating to Israel. The effect of this immigration has been to exacerbate the already grave crisis in the Middle East, and to underscore the central issue discussed later in this book, namely, whether European immigrants are more entitled to live in Palestine than Palestinians. Chapter 3: The Zionist Movement. 1887-1948. Metazodern Zionism as a movement did not originate with the Holocaust survivors, but had a long and eventful history which began in the last century. Nevertheless, the Nazi persecutions and Hitler's final solution, which aroused the sympathies of the world for the Jewish people, were the operative events which culminated in the creation of the State of Israel. However, as Amos Perlmutter 2 points out in his book entitled Israel, The partition state, the present political discords and rivalries within Israel today are simply a continuation and perpetuation of earlier divisions in the Zionist movement. Israel may be territorially secure, but old themes, voices, and faces still seem to echo from the past. The debate over autonomy, the Palestinians, settlements in the West Bank, and over secure boundaries is a variation on old debates that went by other names, and were waged in World Zionist Congress meetings decades ago, in the political halls of the pre-state entity, that was the Yishuv, in the first Knesset, and in the Knessets, flush with undreamt of military victories. To have heard, begin expound passionately on Eretz Israel, the old biblical lands of Israel, was to hear again the voice of revisionist Zionism and its long-dead founder, Zev Jabotinsky. When hearing the leader of the Labour Party, Prime Minister Shimon Peres, complain about Begin's autocratic ways, one must remember how fiercely Labour's founder and father, David Ben-Gurion, tried to stamp out the followers of revisionist Zionism, and recall how deep the struggle really goes. Old themes, old fears, and old drives are still very much alive in today's Israel frontiers, security, the Arab question, Palestine, Eretz Israel, internal political struggles, and the world at large. Perlmutter's scholarly analysis of the philosophical and political history of Zionism is enlightening but discouraging, when one realizes that the same issues and conflicts which existed almost a century ago are no closer to resolution today. Indeed, the fears, obsessions, and ambitions which dominated earlier debates have since been magnified and intensified by two world wars, the Holocaust, five Arab-Israeli wars, and the recent Palestinian uprising. Perlmutter in his book summarizes the situation in these words: the question after the 1984 elections is not of one government or another survival. Israel appears once again to be defining and redefining its territorial aspirations, which is the essence of the politics of security of the third partition state. As in the days before statehood, the same question is being asked and debated: what are the final boundaries of the state? The answers to that question are, it is hoped, to be found in this book. Different men throughout Israel's history and prehistory have answered this question differently. For Theodor Herzl, there were no boundaries, no real country or state, only the passionate notion that the Jews must find a homeland of their own. For Chaim Weizmann, the Jewish state was indelibly tied to the British mandatory, which existed like some protective umbrella overhead. For David Ben-Gurion, neither a fundamentalist nor a visionary, the boundaries of the state were flexible, never finally fixed, dependent on the nature and need of the historical moment. For Zev Jabotinsky, who violently opposed the idea of any sort of partition, and even more so for Menachem Begin, the caretaker of Jabotinsky's ideas, the state meant unpartitioned Eretz Israel, complete Israel, the old biblical lands of Judea and Samaria, in which there is no room for real Palestinian autonomy, let alone a Palestinian state. Thus, the political history of Israel and its institutions becomes a description of a great debate over boundaries, argued by great men who then enacted imperfect resolutions of that debate. As we can see in Israel today, in Lebanon, and in the West Bank, the debate goes on. Emphasis, therefore, even a limited understanding of the political and religious forces at work in Israel today requires some historical perspective. The acknowledged father of modern Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was a journalist born in Budapest in 1860, and an assimilated Jew. His historic role is remarkable, considering the fortuitous circumstances under which, it as a journalist, he took on as an assignment the notorious Dreyfus case. The case was an international sensation involving Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish French army officer, who had been falsely accused of treason by a Gentile officer, who was later proven to be the guilty party. The trial caused the latent anti-Semitic emotions in the French army and in the French people to surface violently. This convinced Herzl that emancipation and assimilation had failed the Jews of Europe, and that the only solution was for the Jews to have a homeland of their own. He was not concerned about the particular location of such a homeland, only that it would be Jewish and a place where Jews could live in peace and security. However, he met strong opposition from many assimilated, as well as Orthodox Jews, the latter of whom believed that only the coming of the Messiah could bring about a new Zion. Nevertheless, Herzl persevered in his